Hi everyone, here we are for another episode of Off The Shelf with me, Michael Dawson, and my co-host, Paul Miles. How are you, mate?
I'm all good, thank you. Here we are again. The weather's getting better. Look at it out there. The pitches are being done. Beautiful.
The weather's getting better. The pitches are looking marvellous, by the way. I don't think I could even control it bad out there.
Easy. I'm not saying a word.
Or everyone at home watching or listening, by the way, because they'll be giving us some stick as well.
I'm sure they will. Special guest today.
Wow, have we? Something completely different.
Yeah.
And I think this guest today will be amazing for so many people to listen to and take from. For me as an ex-player, went through things, different experiences, but I'm so intrigued to listen to him, his knowledge and how he works with players and different people. So, are you introducing him, Mike?
You can introduce him,
Michael. Right. Carl Steptoe, sports psychologist, welcome.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Thank you very much for taking the time out to come and speak to us, along with everyone who's going to be listening. So let's talk about your journey into football first.
Yeah, like a lot of colleagues of mine, I had a sporting background. I played professional sport. If you're wondering how good I was at that, the fact that I'm here probably gives you a clue, not as good as I would have liked. But I think the mental side of the game always interests me. Mm. And so, yeah, that started that journey. Probably self-help to start with, trying to understand why I didn't perform as well as I did and why a game that I loved went from loving it to hating it.
What was your sport, by the way?
I was a golf professional.
Golf. Oh, right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Not to any great standard. Club pro, played local tournaments, a few, local but not big European events that you'd see on TV. But yeah, absolutely loved the sport, lived for it, and then it became this thing that I absolutely hated and dreaded and got very anxious about. So I found that fascinating as well as being very uncomfortable. And then I coached for a bit and found that lots of people, the biggest barrier to their performance was more mental than technical and physical. So that's where that journey started. Lifelong Tottenham fan, lifelong football fan as well. And so after I retrained, I did my PhD in something called choking under pressure to try and understand why people struggled in big pressure moments. And then fell into football, really. Fortunately, the Premier League at that time started to look at psychology provision in football clubs and basically mandated that academies in particular needed to start providing for young footballers. And so I guess my first entry into football was brilliant. Football finally wants psychology. And if I'm honest, I now realise that they had to have it rather than wanted it at the time. And so the last 12, 13 years has been privileged to be on that journey with various football clubs, seeing how they've really supported it as we as a discipline have had to work hard to show how we can add value and what we do. So yeah, it's been a whistle-stop tour. It's still really early stages, but I think football in many ways should be commended for leading the way in what it's trying to do, but we've still got so much to do. Yeah. So yeah, that's pretty much the route.
Yeah, I mean, look, I played for many, many years and I look how far we've gone with the mental side of talking about it, psychology. Do you see that as well? I mean, I'm talking when I started out 23 years ago, I worked with a psychologist in the academy, and then when I got to first team level, it probably went out a little bit. Do you see even more of it now?
Yes, and of course, I'm not across every club. I speak to colleagues at other clubs as well. I think that's a fair reflection. I think there's probably still more structured stuff going on at academy level. And understandably, as players get older, they're probably left to find their own support. You know, they're supported in finding that support, but you're not going to be given it necessarily. We'll help you find that support. I think we're getting better at talking about it. It's the next step that's then important. So you've talked about it, now what? When I speak to players, one thing that's probably equal or worse than having no support at all is being told you're going to get support and then there's nothing there. That can leave someone feeling very underwhelmed. If you imagine the courage it takes, when we're talking in the mental health space, the courage it takes for a player to share something, that might take 2-3 years of build up sometimes to actually reach out and go, look, I'm struggling with something here, can you help? If having been told to share, you're then met with no support, that can be a real setback. So I think across the board, lots of messaging around talking and sharing. I think there is more of a willingness to do that, and I think we've got to continue to do a better job of what do we do when someone does share.
Why do you think that players nowadays, or people in the public, are more open about these troubles, if we can say that, that the mental side, that people who are having issues are more open than we were probably 20 years ago?
Well, I'd like to think it's because it's more normalised. So when they do see people that they put on a pedestal of, they must be really robust, they must be mentally, have a real good quality of mental functioning. When they see that that's not the case and it challenges their worldview, it just normalises that experience. You know, I think in Western society, we have this belief that, you know, if we're more successful, we have more money, then that leads to more happiness. And, you know, the data doesn't back that up and people's experiences don't back that up. I think, I don't know what it's been like for you guys, but for me, I've always had this thought of, oh, I'll be more confident when, you know, if I win that tournament or if I pass that qualification, well, I've got a bathroom full of certificates and I feel no more confident than the day I got the first one, because you can't delete those thoughts. So I think when people at home see actors, celebrities, football players share that, hang on, look, I'm successful and I have this, that's quite a comforting thing. And leads people to think that, okay, this thing might not be so restrictive on my life, because you can achieve some amazing things while feeling this stuff. And also, you can get help at that stage as well.
You mentioned that, look, people are beginning to, are more willing to talk about these things now. Are you finding there's almost less of, you always felt there was a bit of a stigma attached to talking about mental health within the football environment?
Yeah.
Are you finding that less so now?
Me personally, but I also know that colleagues probably don't share that experience. I think back to one of my very first opportunities in football, I was asked to see certain players, and they were the players that had problems. So from day one, problems in inverted commas, so from day one, we set a culture of, if you go and speak to Carl, there's something wrong. Mm. And so players wouldn't want to do that because, again, you're in a selection sport.
Yeah.
And not with any intention, not that people were maliciously saying that if you've got an issue, that means you're no good. But in the back of the mind, a coach might think, can I trust that player on a Saturday? Or are they in the right headspace to play? They might be doing it to support the player, but that player is not going to want to come forward. So I'd have some comical situations where I'd be driving, 100 miles to go and see a group of players, only for them to say, can you give me a phone when you get home? You know, because it wasn't safe to have that conversation there. Again, that's no criticism of any of football particularly. It's just that was how they survived. I need to get selected. And there are mixed messages. On one hand, we're saying talk and share. But on the other hand, there's not a day goes by where I don't hear the word resilience in a football club.
Yeah.
So you ask a young person or a footballer who's struggling with something, they've got a choice. Do I talk and share, or do I show resilience? Mm. That's a very confusing message for a young person.
Yeah.
Completely agree with that. As an ex-player that went through, would I say mental challenges? I'd say confidence. Mm-hmm. That's what I thought it was when I was playing and I was here. And sat at this amazing training centre, and you don't realise the pressures of playing for a big football club.
No.
I then took a major step back and went to a team that was fighting for relegation, different kinds of pressures.
Yeah.
And I've spoke to people here, and how do you deal with that pressure? How do you deal with not performing to the level that you've probably set the bar there 3-4 years ago and you're now there? So how do you get your level back to there when you know it's in your mindset? So what would you say to those kind of people who are listening to that? Because confidence is huge. You sit here now, people fight, public speaking isn't always easy.
Yes.
So you have to overcome these challenges, and confidence for me in any walk of life can be hard.
I think there's two things that come to mind, Michael, that everyone has mental health. I think if we are better educated now, I think there's an appreciation that everyone has mental health, whereas previously it was talked about in its negative form. You've got a mental health issue.
Yeah.
So we all have mental health, and it fluctuates day to day for random things. I think where we are at the moment, and I'd rather we were getting it wrong this way, I think everyone's very nervous about missing on mental health related issues. So everything has become a mental health issue. The reason I'm saying this is if a footballer comes to me, whatever level, first team or academy player, and coach either refers them or they've got an anxiety about a cup final or a performance or being deselected. That's a normal human response to disappointment. There is a stimulus, there's a football match that I'm anxious about. That is not a mental health issue. Anxiety, which is can be clinical in nature, that's someone sitting in their room with no stimulus, there's no danger, but just imagining a threat and there's fear. Yeah. So we're in a stage now for me in my role as a sport and exercise psychologist where everything's becoming very clinical. This person's anxious, they've got depression. No, their mood has fluctuated and their mental health is poor today, but they don't have clinically diagnosed depression, which requires a whole different treatment pathway. And I think that's important because there are people that are living with mental health issues and that needs to be seen for that. And for people that are worried about a match at the weekend or struggling at being deselected, there's a different level of support for that. So that's the first piece. We've got to get better at distinguishing between the two. In answer to your question about what would we say to people that are having those concerns about confidence, well, confidence is a state. Again, it fluctuates. And I think what fascinates me about my job is we are the only living things that can think themselves into an emotion. So as we sit here now, we can tell stories. You might be able to reminisce about a time in your career. And as you connect with that story, you might feel it on some level, but we're just sat here. Mm. So if we can think and feel ourselves into an emotion, we have to hold lightly how true it actually is, because we're just sat here now. So when I work with people, it's helping them to realize we are thinking and feeling machines. And if we can have a better relationship with those thoughts and feelings and not just act on them, we can function better in life. Because I can wake up some days and think, oh, I'm a bit down today. Mm. Might be a song on the radio that, I don't know, an ex-girlfriend left me for, you know? And all of a sudden my mood is low. Yeah. Am I going to hand my day over to those thoughts and feelings when they are just thoughts and feelings? So I know that's a long-winded answer, but there are things we can do to get people into confident states. But they don't last forever, they're temporary. But there are lots of things we can do to influence that state. And again, it's about psychology for me, not the psychologist. Everyone works in this space. You know, we work closely with player care, player liaison in other sports, safeguarding, coaches of the psychologists, partners, teammates. So it's about ensuring that psychology is embedded in a system and that people have got support. Not just from professional psychologists, but from all people that can influence their mental health and well-being.
Our former players, Danny Rose, Stephen Caulker, women's first team player, Molly Bartrop, on the off the shelf, have all spoken about mental health issues that they've been through.
Yeah.
When you look at the sport, I mean, you look at the Premier League, such a huge audience. They've sort of spoken about their issues. How important is it that footballers can do this for the wider public, really? Seeing these players talk about their issues and what it can do for their supporters and the wider audience.
And football, even though it's a very unique environment, it's not so unique that it's immune to the stats that we have in the general population. If one in four people in the UK is going to experience a mental health issue, and we know people have trouble disclosing, so that number's probably nearer 2 in 4. You know, half the people will have some experience of poor mental health. Then football's going to be no different. So it's great that we're getting people talking, but like a load of other issues in sport, I'm sure there are a lot more that are suffering in silence or living with mental health issues in a bit more silence. So it's vital that people get to hear, as I said before, that people can, I think that's the biggest message for me, that mental health is something that we all have. Poor mental health is something that we can live with. No one's saying it's enjoyable, but these challenges, these issues, these conditions, if that's what it is, are things that we can live with and don't have to be so restricting on living a full life. We all have this, again, a very Western thing, this pursuit of happiness, and this ideal that life, there's a life out there where I'm not going to have all these negative experiences. And unfortunately, that's not life. So really, it's about our willingness to live the fullest life possible, perform to the highest level with what is inevitable, uncomfortable experience. Yeah. Thoughts and feelings that will show up from nowhere. Are we willing to have those? Or as in the cases of the guests you've had on before, are they so uncomfortable that I have to engage in activities that help me avoid them? So drinking, so gambling, the problem with those behaviours is they work short term. They help me get rid of something that feels really uncomfortable. Long term, it comes at the cost of something far more important. So, it's challenging, it's difficult. It's not a very exciting sell because you're saying to people, I wish that we had the ability to get rid of thoughts, feelings. Have you ever got rid of a thought? It's a trick question because if you can tell me the thought, you haven't got rid of it, right? but in my, there are thoughts that I have as a late 40s man that I had when I was 5 years old, getting up on stage at assembly, don't make a fool of yourself, those sort of things. So you put me in the context of being on show, that thought of don't mess up will show up. So it's your willingness to have that thought and still do those things that matter.
In football clubs, Carl, we have nutritionists, we have sports science, we have physios, we have everything. Psychologists and the mental health side, do you think that gets appreciated as much as it should do? Or it certainly didn't back in the day when I was playing.
No, but in fairness, I don't think that's football's responsibility. I think I'm passionate about my profession, but also very critical of it. I think we have to do a better job of showing how we add value. My envy at those other professions that you talk about is they can objectively measure what they do. If I could prove, in inverted commas, that I add value, everyone would have a psychologist working full time. If I could prove that I could make a difference to how we play at the weekend, no one would question it, right?
You say that, Carl, but now we've got players who are in the game still now, players that are out the game, are talking about it. So surely that does give you...
It does, but for whatever reason, that account of... I feel better because I had therapy or I worked with a sports psychologist and it improved my performance. That verbal account isn't as strong as seeing someone run faster, see them jump higher, score more goals. If someone scored more goals after working with me, how could I honestly pick out the contribution that I've played in that beyond the technical, beyond the physical, whatever? So I, of course, I'm not diluting what we do and talking myself out of a job. Yeah. My call to my colleagues and my professionals, we've got to do a better job of how do we measure it. So something like anxiety, we mentioned previously, there's lots of different flavours of psychology. And I'm sitting here only presenting my flavour, my philosophy on psychology. Something like anxiety, you can measure multiple ways. I could look at your brain functioning and say that person is anxious. I could get you to fill out a questionnaire on anxiety. I could get you to talk and tell me about your anxiety, or I could look at your behavior. Now, all of those things are different ways of measuring anxiety. We've got to decide in sport which ones are most useful. So a coach that's picking a player and wants to pick players that aren't anxious can't see brain function. Mm. So that's a pointless way of measuring it. In football, I choose to try and encourage us to look at behaviors. Because for a player that's getting selected, it doesn't matter whether you are anxious, you've got to demonstrate that you're not. So are you willing to think and feel anxious thoughts? Don't mess up, this is going to be really bad. But can you stand there and present in a way that looks like you're confident and certain and those sorts of things?
You say that, Carl, but if now I'm a pundit, I watch football and I look at a player that has been there and they gradually start going backwards, not performing to the level that they've set, and we've all given them great credit, and then all of a sudden they come back up. So there's a reason why they've gone from there, to then going back up. Whether it's your lifestyle, speaking to psychologists, people outside this building won't know who you speak to. I don't know who you speak to, or the football clubs. But if you're in the building, you will have known who you've spoke to, that were there, went to there, spoke to them, and then got them back to the level that it should be. So surely you say managers don't understand. Is that true?
Yeah, it's not that managers don't understand, it's just that they're looking at psychology through a particular lens. I'm going to make a decision on someone's mental state, not based on what they're thinking and feeling, because I can't see that. I'm going to make my judgment on their mindset, where their head's at, based on their behavior. I'm going to make an assumption of someone's motivation based on whether they turn and track back after they lose a ball. So we're making it's an educated guess, but we don't know for certain that that's a motivational issue or an anxious issue or a confidence issue. So we're making just educated assumptions about someone's mental state. And don't get me wrong, I'm by no means saying that a psychologist won't play a role in that return back, but I'd have to be pretty confident myself to say that was down to me and this piece of work, because there's so many variables that go into it. So psychology is really important. My call on us as a profession is we've got to get on the same page with regard to, well, how are we measuring it? Mm. My question to anyone who I work with is, in a year from now, how would you know that I've made a difference? Now, if you say to me, because players will think better, I'd be surprised. What you're going to ask for in a performance environment is that they perform in a certain way. They are more motivated. They're composed under pressure. They make good decisions. Mm. Well, these are all behaviours. So if you're going to make judgments on players based on behaviour, let's make psychology a behaviour thing. Let me work on how they think and feel. But all you need to know is, or all the player needs to know is, the assumption will be you are motivated if you turn up on time, if you track back when you lose the ball, if you're up for it against a team on a wet Wednesday versus a cup final. Well, these are the things that tell us whether someone is in a good state. Yeah.
Carl, I want to ask you about just the importance of actually just speaking, getting through the door. I mean, Richarlison spoke about how talking to someone helped him. Aaron Lennon was on off the shelf. He said exactly the same. Denny Dawes.
Brilliant.
I mean, a lot of people would see it as quite daunting approaching a psychologist. But how important is it they get through the door?
It is really important, and I think that's why we've got to not demystify it. There is a skill in listening. We as human beings want to generally solve problems and make things better. I'm the worst psychologist with my daughter because when she feels uncomfortable, I want to take it away. So I don't listen as well. I'm seeing someone that's close to me in pain, finding difficulty, and so I want to solve the problem. And so I become a bad psychologist because I'm a father in that moment. And so the role in that space on the outside might not look too complicated, but the moment someone feels like they're able to share and there is no judgment on this, I'm going to listen to your story, because sometimes people bring stories that to them feel insignificant compared to other stories that they've heard. There are people in football that have experienced some horrific on-field events and horrific events away from their life. Stephen shared the story of while he was away and the accident.
The accident,
So there's not a competition over whose experience is worse than another. Someone could have something that seems quite small, but it affect them in the same way. So to have a space to share that story, not be judged, and talk through how that feels and how they are coping with that, I think in that moment can be very beneficial in itself. It's not a magic cure, but it's not always that you're going to have to do all this work and training and intervention. The very act of sharing and letting this out and recognising it and facing it front on can be really helpful.
Is that the biggest step, getting through the door?
I think so. And that's why we've got to find multiple ways for people to reach out. It's not just having someone at the club. It's making sure that if that person is just exposed to the fact that psychology or support in the mental health space is supported at a club, and here are some resources. If you want to go and make that phone call in private, or if you want to reach out to the PFA, or if you want to reach out to any member of staff at a club, there's someone there that hopefully what they would say is, I don't know what this help looks like, but we're going to get you some support. And that's the message I'd have to staff, because it can be quite overwhelming for staff to deal with as well. You don't have to feel this pressure to have all the answers. Just someone knowing that they've been heard and you're going to get them the support and you follow up on that is massive.
I was just going to say there, Carl, obviously everyone who works in the football club has the opportunity to see you. But what about people who are on the outside? Where do they start? You're now home alone, you think, I need some help. What would you recommend? What's the first thing you do?
Yeah, and this is the hardest thing about the job, I suppose, that we are where we are. We're privileged in this country to have a National Health Service and support that's there, but it falls way short of the need. So I think people's personal experience sometimes is through their GP, 100%. Right. I think the first thing to say, more importantly, is if someone's at risk of harm to themselves or others, then that's a 999 call, 100%. And I've had to, unfortunately, do that on a number of occasions. If you think someone's at risk of harm to themselves or others, then it's that call. Then it's 111, and you might have someone there that you can talk through what you're seeing or observing in this person, and they will direct you to appropriate services. GP, and as we go down this route, unfortunately, the wait time becomes a little bit longer. And then we've got a parallel system of private support. And the challenges with that, there's wait times, often 4 to 6 weeks, and then there's a cost associated with that. if you look at counselling directories, psychotherapy, there's lots of directories out there where you can search for people in a local area. You can put in what you're experiencing. You might, you know, put in a few keywords about feeling depressed or a little anxious, and you can just find someone out there that way. But pick up the phone, and then the go-to is Samaritans. Other than that, but yeah, just being able to talk to someone who will then help find the right process for you is vital.
This is one for Michael, really, but I just want to sort of go down the line now of mental health and performance.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to start this because Michael will take over, no doubt. But I mean, you've come out of golf, and we both play golf. I can't think of another sport where, you know, it's so psychological, because you're like a machine, and any little cog in that machine that goes wrong means the ball's going there, it's going there, it's going 4 feet in front of you. You've come out, I mean, you were a professional golfer.
A long time ago, yeah.
I mean, what I'm saying is, what is the impact that you know from performance and mental health? Where does that go hand in hand?
Yeah, you can't separate the two. You know, if someone's performing well, then that tends to have a positive influence on their well-being on that day. And if someone's got good mental health, then that'll have a positive influence on performance, because their attention is where it needs to be. So if you just think about it from an attention perspective, if my mind is on unhelpful thoughts, threat-related thoughts, fear, worry, anxiety, and those sorts of things, and it's not on my job, then I'm going to see some performance loss in what I do. So you can't separate those two things out. I take your point on golf. I think a lot of people say that about golf, but all sports have a massive psychological component. There are just different demands of different sports. So in golf, you have a lot of time, but when I work in cricket, blimey, you've got even more time in cricket, you know, and you're away for long periods. And you've got the dynamic of a team sport. Cricket masquerades as a team sport, but the players will tell you it's very individual, batter versus bowler. Football, yes, it does look like a team sport, but when you're coming up through the ranks, it doesn't often feel like a team, because sometimes you're competing for a place with another left back. There's going to be one scholarship. There's going to be one place in that 21s team, or you're all getting sent over to train with the first team. And hang on, do I want my teammate to do well? Well, yes, on a human level, but really I want to get further. So there are different demands. With football, from a performance perspective, the different demand is you don't have time to think. A lot of your skills are executed in a very automated way. In tennis is the sport that fascinates me, how close they can get to a baseline running at speed. I mean, the precision in that. But if you look at football and a player's got a one-on-one with a keeper, or tennis, the ball's been lobbed up and they've got time. Now you add time to the mix, you can see the skill breakdown. So often you'll see player one-on-one with a keeper, time to think. This is now a cognitive psychological process that's taking place, skill breaks down. Whereas ball flies over, respond, go, we score some amazing goals. And that, the thing that gets me, I'm sorry to dig out pundits, but we talk about instinct. It's not an instinct. You're not born playing football. We only have very few instincts as human beings, things like blinking, drinking, hunger, thirst, those sorts of things. Scoring goals in a moment is not an instinct. It's a learnt behaviour. The reason I get hung up on that is, if someone thinks it's an instinct, then it suggests that you've either got it or you haven't. Now, you can learn to do that. Now, everyone has got different ranges of capabilities, but if it's instinctual, it's like you're born a footballer, this was always destined to be. No, you learn those skills.
I always think, Carl, it's like, so if you're a golfer and you hook one into the lake, 5 seconds later, you're standing above your ball and you've got to do it properly, especially at the elite level. You've got to do it. If you're a snooker player and you miss a pot, next time you're at the table, you've got to pot it. If you're a darts player, you miss a double, you've got to go back and hit the next double. As a footballer, if you make a mistake, a minute later, you could be in exactly the same situation, like taking chances, for instance.
Yes.
So how, this again, this is what I'm talking about, hand in hand with being mentally strong.
Yeah, sure.
It seems more so from the outside looking in that, you know, your individual sports, you'd always think you've got to be mentally stronger. But I'm thinking in football, it's the same, because
absolutely,
it's the same situation, isn't it?
Do you not think though, Carl, someone can help you through a bad time or a dip in form, lacking confidence, when you're in a team sport than an individual sport? I play golf, I've started playing paddle tennis. When I'm having a nightmare, I know I'm having a nightmare. And who can get me out of that? Only me. If I'm playing bad in a team sport,
Your teammate can come on.
Miles, he might get me out. Yeah. Carl might put one in from 25 yards. So we win the game 1-0. We've all been poor, but my confidence has gone from getting beat 4-0.
Because you've done it. You're the fault of it. We've won it as a team.
Yeah. Yeah, individual, yeah. There's one person get you out of that trouble.
Yeah. Yeah, different demands. And this is where I say it's about the psychology and not the psychologist. If I'm working with a tennis player whose coach isn't even allowed to speak to them during a tournament, then it's more important to them that they've got strategies in between play, when they're sat in the chair, to help them manage what's going on for them. With a golfer, most of my work's with the caddy. The caddy's the psychologist because he can see the behaviours. He can guess that the player's got the hump about the last shot. Yeah. You can tell when players are ruminating and thinking backwards. I think Aaron alluded to this in your discussion with him, that the mind goes forwards and backwards. You can tell when a goalkeeper's still thinking about an error because head's down, maybe muttering to themselves, or if someone's mind's gone to the future and they're worrying. That's the best thing about anxiety. It hasn't happened yet. It's someone thinking ahead. Mm. So a caddy can know his player inside out and think, okay, I think he's getting ahead of himself here, bring him back to the present. In football, your teammates might be able to notice. We talk about, oh, their head's gone, but where's it gone? Has it gone forward? Are they worrying? You might notice in the dressing room their head's gone forward, their head down, they're shaking their knee, they're worrying. And so if you notice that, you can help bring them back to the present. Because as I say, you're just thinking yourself into a state. Yeah. Or you might be going backwards, going over a past performance and thinking yourself into low mood and disappointment and anger. So the ability to notice that, which is everyone's gift, and help someone come back to the present and switch on, as we call it, is really important, absolutely.
Kyle, you touched on the academy side there. Mm. So we've all come through the scholarship, you've made it, two centre-halves, one's going to get kept. How does it differ between working with the academy players to the first team?
Far more developmental, as you would expect. I think this is what I'm most proud of the discipline, is that we're getting better at being proactive. I think a lot of the things that we've talked about to this point have been about the support for when someone is struggling. And I think where we can now start to do a better job is to equip people with the skills they need to meet the known demands of football. Because I think that's the thing. I don't think in 15 years of working in football, there's been a topic that is new. It's not like we couldn't have predicted that you're going to experience deselection, disappointment, challenges with coaches, challenges with teammates, injury. So to meet these events as if we didn't think they were possible and then be going, right, now what? Where's the support? Is a shame. So I think we need to do a better job of equipping people with the skills and strategies to meet these demands, so that gives them a confidence. That actually reduces fear, because, hang on, I know that when I get deselected, I've got the skills to cope with this. If and when I do get injured, because just by talking about it doesn't mean it's going to happen, so we have to be able to talk about it. I know where the support is and I know how I'm going to use my time in that space. So I think there's still a bit of putting it off until it happens. In academy football, it's far more equipping people with skills to help them meet those demands.
Let me put one to you then, Michael. When you were having that tough time under Juan de Ramos, if Carl was around, would you have gone to have a chat? We're talking, what, 2008?
Probably not. Because it was only probably when I moved to Hull that I realised that I was lacking major confidence. Mm. And I had major pressure and that fear of failure, of rejection, which you look at the academy players might have. I was in the first team then, I'd played an awful lot of games, but you still have that, Miles is coming in, he's going to knit your place, and so now you're sub. So Carl comes in. You're not even sub, you're now fourth choice and you're out. So now you think you failed as a player. Fear of failure, which now when I speak to people, is huge.
And that, even though you've had all of those wonderful experiences and reached the heights of the game, that fear of failure, if I'm understanding correctly, didn't go. It went for periods, but it didn't go forever. In a different environment, it pops up again. So in 2008, that fear of failure popped up. That's my point. If the goal here is to get rid of it, I can see how desirable that is, but you're going to have a long wait for it to go. Recognizing that thought of failure will show up in different situations is where you have the power, because you have choice in how you respond. I can either respond to this feeling and try and avoid it and get rid of it, or push it down. which is really draining for people. The players that I work with, they talk about this struggle with their mind, trying to keep it down. And Molly mentioned that in her video about, she talked about her head or her mind. She almost like had this separate name to it. The battle to keep it in check can be draining in itself. And that can lower mood. It can affect performance. If you're spending all your time trying to manage that anxiety. So the reason it's important to talk is we can let go of the struggle a little bit. It's not very exciting, but we're going to have to lean in and make room for what is just thoughts and feelings. And that is where the start can happen.
Do you know you say that, Carlo, but in our industry, you're there or you're there.
Yep.
So how do you deal with academy players that has just been released? What do you say to those kids? I mean, look, I talk about 2008. That was the first time I came. I'd gone through the academy. Great, brilliant. Mm. Got into the first team at 18. Got bought at 21. Came here, all right, I had an injury, but I hadn't failed then.
Yeah.
I'd then gone to the peak of where I thought, playing in the Premier League, this is easy. Then all of a sudden my form started dipping. So that was my first time that I thought, I'm in big trouble here. My career's going one way. What do you do if you're an academy player? How do they deal with that? And what do you say to them?
So I think, as I say, we try and do a better job of preparing them for those events, but we try and expose them in a safe way to, for example, if we use fear of failure as an example, rather than them having a strategy of my way to the top is to avoid failing, is to put some potential failure in place. What we have done in a bizarre way is sometimes we can make the environment so safe that people aren't experiencing challenge. And so I have to come in and put challenge in. You're like, well, if I wasn't here and we didn't do this 20 years ago, I'm sure there's players that would say, yeah, we had far more challenge. So now we have to design challenges so that people can practice responding to failure in a more positive way. So over their time at an academy, I would hope that we can get them to respond better to failure so they get an experience of what it's like to have disappointment and failure, and they can respond in a more helpful way. We try and look at their beliefs about what it means to fail. So, okay, failing here, does that mean that you failed in terms of your long-term goals, and what are the other opportunities? Drawing on your guys' experiences and looking at their idols and role models to normalize that route, for them to know that it's not this linear path from under eights all the way through to first team and Champions League success. You might go up, down again, and all the way back in again. Stephen sharing that story of the coming back and having that opportunity at Liverpool as well, that there's a lot of different routes. But if we just hold up these very stereotypical routes into football, it can create a lot of fear and anxiety, because the perception is, if I fail here at 12s, or if I get released, or I don't get a new registration, or I don't get that scholarship, that's my career done. No, it just means your scholarship opportunity is not going to be here. What's next? What's next? What's next?
Do you see parents putting more pressure on their kids than what there was 20, 30, 40 years ago because of the limelight that we see in the Premier League? We see the glitz, the glamour. So every parent is wanting to see their child be a Harry Kane. And what would you say to those parents?
I love working with parents. It's like walking a tightrope, because you're telling a parent how to be a parent, right? They're the experts on their kids, and we just bring a different perspective to it and saying, look, we know that if we support in this way, it'll have better outcomes longer term. Do I see them putting more pressure on? Probably, but only because we see it more. It's not that it didn't go on 20, 30 years ago. It's just we probably didn't see it as much. We have academies that accommodate parents, so they're around the building a lot more. So I think it would be very unfair to say today's parents are more apply more pressure. I just think it's more visible. They are human beings with thoughts and feelings as well. So they will come to an academy and a football club with their own anxieties. You know, I once spoke to a parent at a club. I was speaking to parents of all age groups, and he came up to me at the end of the session and said, Carl, I just don't want my son to waste this opportunity. And I didn't know what age his son was. And his son was in the pre-academy, he was 8. And I had to say to him, what do you think the opportunity is? Because we give them the shirt, we make them feel part of the club, and now what you've given them is something that at some stage is definitely going to go. Yeah. It's definitely going to go. It might be at 10, it might be at 12, it might be at 35, but one day this is going to end. The opportunity is to have some footballs, some good services, and some fantastic coaching. That's the opportunity. Mm. So you've got parents that are treading on eggshells, that are trying, and it's all understandable. So I think we need to come from a position of not criticizing the parents, which I know we don't do. It's understanding that they bring a whole load of stuff. They're trying to do the best for their kids. Mm. So if we can shape and educate and say, look, you're both going to be on this journey. You might be here together for 10 years. What's this going to look like for you, and how can we support them through all these transitions?
I think I can probably answer one of my own questions there. as a parent, I think I stand on a touchline at a weekend, I speak to ex-pros, and every ex-pro talks about their kid. They all seem to stand back and don't say an awful lot. They're not ranting and raving. People say to me, why don't you coach? I went, I've been there, I've played it, and I know how hard it is to get to the top. Yeah. So for my son to go and do it, and everyone else's son, I always say just let them enjoy it. That for me is the biggest advice I would ever pass to any parent, and just be there.
The thing we know most, Mike, I suppose, consistently is that at an early age, these behaviours that we talk about that look like good psychological performance are modelled by parents. So it's not a knowledge thing. I'll sit with parents in a workshop or in one-to-ones, and we'll nod and agree logically that they know that they need to be calm and composed. Mm. But pitch side, and their son's been taken off, or their son's having a bad game, or their daughter's having a bad game, their own emotions, they now start modelling, hang on, I can't cope with this. So they're modelling, this is how you respond to anxiety. You start shouting, or you start questioning the son or daughter on the way home in the car. So we've got to look at how are we modelling our response to anxiety, you know, because the child will learn, well, that's how you deal with those things as well. So there's loads that parents can do, but not from a position of criticism. It's like, we've got an opportunity here to help shape how your son or daughter goes through this academy experience.
The last subject we just want to talk about, Carl, is one that fascinates me, and one that Michael again can talk about here, is retired players. So, you know, if they come into the academy age 8 and then have a good career and they're in the spotlight and everything that comes with being a professional footballer, you know, at the age of, say, 35, 36, you know, you retire, and then all of a sudden on July the 1st, you're not coming in for pre-season training, you're not having 3 meals a day, you're not being... It all ends like that. I know there's support out there. What support is out there? And I'm sure Michael can talk about, you know, he recently retired, you know, the impact that can have on you as a person and on your mental health.
Yeah, I mean, the structured support, it's the same theme, really. It's probably as good as it's been, and we continue to need to ensure that gets better. So, yeah, from PFA support, from Sporting Chance, from the psychologists and player care, player liaison staff that are in a club, there's a whole range of support. For me, if it got to that stage, my heart sinks, because it's not that we're too late. We should have caught this earlier. And I think, Michael, you'll be better positioned to share colleagues' experience of this. It seems that the people that seem to navigate that transition better have been thinking about it a bit more in advance, or they have an identity that's broader than just football. And here's the rub. Here's where I feel like we failed you in mixed messaging, is we've told you for 30 years that you've got to dedicate your life to football. You've got to give it 100% and make sacrifice. And then you're going to have someone like me tell you when you get to your mid-30s that you're more than just a footballer. Well, hang on. No, I've just lived the first part of my life and that's all I am. So when you take all I am away, what are you left with? Nothing. Mm. So I think we do a better job now, hopefully, as I say, not even scratching the surface, of trying to not dilute the message of sacrifice. It's with young people saying, well, no, education is important. Football is a priority because it's the thing you're doing right now, but it's not all you are. You're a brother, you're a sister, you're a son, you're all of these things. You have multiple identities. And I think what we found from a psychology perspective is those people who have a broader identity, who start that planning, have some optimism, are involved in that planning, and it's not being done to them, tend to transition much more successfully.
Yeah, I would completely agree with what Carl says there. And I was very fortunate, and still am, but I was always thinking, when I was 30, I did my B licence with John McDermott, then obviously I left, and I had my son, so coaching went on the back burner. And then when I was coming to the end, I thought, right, I did my A licence, I'd started dipping my toe into the media, but then also on another side, you're still playing. The Forest was still paying me, thinking, I want you to play football, not be thinking about when you finish. So it's a two-way thing, but as a player's point of view, you have to look after yourself. You have to think of your next chapter in life, because it does come to us all. You do have to hang your boots up. But I've been very fortunate. I'll always be grateful. Look, the club brought me back as ambassador. Sky gave me the opportunity to go and do Soccer Saturday, which is great. So still involved in football, still love it, but there's an awful lot of coaches out there. So not everyone gets an opportunity to go and be a coach, go and work in the media. But you certainly need something as an ex-player to have, get up in the morning, whether it's your kids, your family, but then that can't be just it. For me, you have to have something for yourself, go to work and keep the mental side, because you've had a structure and you've been, you're here at this time. All of a sudden, you can do what you want, when you want. And sometimes it sounds great for the first 6 months, and then after that you think, wow, I'm still only 35, 32,
you've got a massive hole to fill.
Hopefully you live for.
You've got a massive hole to fill, but you've been in and around 20 close friends for 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years, haven't you? And all of a sudden, you're not walking into a room full of them
anymore.
You
miss that. Nothing will ever replace that. Walking into a changing room, whether it be the girls, whether it be the lads, you have fun. That's one thing you always got to remember. When we come to training, I used to love training. Loved it. Like, I'd banter on the pitch, all right? It's your pressure, your job to do it, but we had fun. Come a Saturday, the prime aim was after 90 minutes, you get 3 points. Everyone goes, oh, I'm happy, you do what you want to do. But you have great, great friends, still friends. I saw Danny yesterday, seeing Aaron next week. It's like friends that you played with 10, 15 years ago, but you still keep in contact, and you'll miss that.
It also sounds like you're not chasing that buzz that you got. You recognised that was a big part of your life, that part of it, but football's still part of your identity. You're not chasing that buzz necessarily?
Yeah, I was always one of those players that you always know it's going to come to the end. I didn't always have to be in the limelight. It wasn't always about me. Yeah. Quite happy to sit back.
Yeah.
But as I say, I'm happy. I have a great work-life balance. 2 kids that I'm a good taxi for. Happy wife, happy life. You know what I mean? You say that, all these kind of things. So it's good, but unfortunately, not everyone's like that.
No, and what you've described there is a real broad identity, right? You've got a number of roles beyond just being a footballer.
Yeah.
But people will deal with that transition in a very different way. But again, Premier League-wise, last year or so, new initiatives in which when players are released, we follow up with them as whatever club has a duty to follow up with them over a 2-3 year period, whether they've gone to another club or not. So we're following up and trying to put that support in place, but hopefully we do that work much earlier.
Brilliant. That's brilliant, Carl. And honestly, so interesting. I'm sure people...
Fascinating.
People who have listened to this, watched this, I'm sure you've helped a lot of people, Carl. So thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Carl.
This episode contains topics which some viewers may find triggering. If you're affected by any of the topics in this episode, please visit www.nhs.uk/mental-health.